This is Audible.
Callous and Toll, The Silver Shard, by Nick Horth, read by Barnaby Edwards. Chapter 1. Sunlight trickled down through the canopy of violet leaves and crystalline tree trunks to cast a shimmering amethyst glow across the jungle floor. Chev Arklis knelt, stretched out a hand, and let the light play across her fingers. Around her, a cacophony of life screeched, clicked, and howled. Disc-shaped beetles buzzed by, mandibles twitching. She waved a hand to shoo them away, and their iridescent bodies flashed from blue to a bright red as they zoomed off into the tree line. Truly, the jungles of the Talon Coast would be a beautiful place if they weren't quite so intent on killing her. She reached back and unclipped a flask from her belt. It was worryingly light in her hands. The journey had taken far longer than she had hoped, and the sweltering heat had hardly helped. She let several drops of precious water drip onto her tongue. Scuffed footsteps sounded behind her, and a familiar stench of stale sweat and gunji smoke wafted through the trees. She sighed and turned. There he was, of course, her shadow. His beady, rheumy eyes narrowed in a suspicious frown, while he panted like a hound worn out from the heat, exposing a row of blackened teeth.
"What are you sneaking off for, elf?" he hissed. "Trying to leave us behind, I reckon."
"Where exactly would I run off to, cretin?" she snarled back. "In case you hadn't noticed, howl, there's several hundred leagues of lethal wilderness between us and any scrap of civilization." Howl's eyes narrowed even further, and, as if by magic, a crude, saw-bladed dagger appeared in one hand, and a barbed hook in the other. He trembled with barely contained rage.
"You speak to me like that again, I'll carve up the other side of your face," he said. "You won't be even half pretty by the time I'm done with you."
Chev rose slowly, moving one hand to her belt, and the dagger stowed there. She smiled through the cold rage that filled her, and felt the familiar tautness on the left side of her jaw, where a web of scarred flesh met her upper lip. She'd had just about enough of Howl's taunts, muttered threats, and stares. Chev didn't know quite why the old brute had it in for her so badly, but her patience was at an end.
"You don't frighten me, Howl," she said. "So why don't you—"
"Enough," interrupted a voice, soft and measured. Not a threatening sound, but both she and Howl took a step back nonetheless. The Golden Lord stepped into the clearing. Despite the stifling heat, he still wore thick black robes and an undercoat of leather, revealing not a hint of bare skin. An impassive death mask of gold gazed at them both as the figure leaned upon his black iron staff. Not for the first time, Chev felt a shiver of unease trickle down her back.
"We are near," said the Golden Lord. "I require you to be alert and attentive, not with daggers at each other's throats. The city of Katzaimos awaits. Madam Arklis, please lead the way. Howl, sheathe your blade."
The man had never once raised his voice in her presence, never threatened or struck anyone. And yet a murderous piece of filth like Howl, a thug who'd spent his entire life killing others for profit or enjoyment, obeyed the order at once. That disturbed Chev more than any grandiose posturing or outburst of sudden violence could have. More figures appeared, filtering through the crystal trees. Her companions, thieves, fugitives, and killers to a soul. They were dressed in a variety of hides, leathers, and scraps of metal, and doused in sweat and grime. The journey from Maggerhorn had been long and hard, and only around 50 or so specimens remained, the toughest of the Golden Lord's band. They were among the most repulsive men and women Chev had ever had the misfortune of encountering, and in her line of work, that was a truly impressive feat. Not for the first time she questioned her wisdom in agreeing to this commission, before striding off through the wilds. Think of the prize, she reminded herself. Kat Zymos, the ancient library city, final resting place of Ecclesius the Realms Walker. It was here, somewhere in this valley, and she never would have found it without the Golden Lord's knowledge. How the reams of dusty tomes and yellow maps had entered his possession, she could not say, for they were relics of a bygone age. Combining these priceless treasures with her own research, a lifetime's worth of exploring ruins and long-abandoned tombs across the wilds of the Shattered Coast, of studying, recovering, and analyzing, they had pieced together the truth, the true location of the Realms Walker's tomb. It had not been easy. These lands had changed so much, even in the last few hundred years. It was the way of things along the Talon Coast, far to the north of Excelsis, outside the great city's sphere of influence. Mountain ranges erupted from the land like enormous fangs, breaking the verdant earth, then swallowing it beneath their rocky mass. The raging seas gnawed at the coast, opening new tributaries and headwaters. Maps became hopelessly outdated in only a few decades, as this endlessly predatory realm devoured, then reshaped itself. Yet some things survived, like this hidden valley, encircled by jagged cliffs, locked away from the world. Kat Zymos, where great scholars from across the mortal realms had once gathered to store and disperse their knowledge amongst peers, where the body of Ecclesius, the most prestigious thinker, scientist, and inventor of his age, was interred. Chev's steps grew lighter as she thought about the secrets that awaited her, the fresh mysteries that would inevitably arise from her discoveries. I apologize for the quality of servants I must rely upon, came a voice at her side. It was the gold-masked lord. Reliable souls are a rare breed these days, and so we must compromise. Chev shook her head. You're clearly a learned man. How did you ever find yourself working with this scum? There was a muffled choking sound, and Chev glanced at the man. She realized it was laughter, coarse and painful. I ask myself that very same question every day, he said. The truth is that we do not live in an age of enlightenment, Madame Arklis. Reasoned, thinking people such as we are so few. Killers, however, they abound. We live in an age of war and bloodshed. In such times, we must be realistic. He rested a hand on her arm. The metal was icy against her bare skin. This close to the man, she could smell scented oils and a faint whiff of smoke, as if someone had stirred the ashes of a dead fire. She glanced into the black recesses of his mask's eye sockets, and despite herself, she couldn't suppress a shiver as she glimpsed a pair of cold, flint eyes staring back. She had never dared to ask why the Golden Lord did not reveal his face. She presumed he bore the scars of a hard life, much as she did. Yet Chev had never felt a desire to hide her disfigurement from the world. These brutes will earn their gold and go back to their wasteful, cruel lives a little richer, he whispered. You and I will discover the truths that are buried here, and then we will move on, seeking the answers to the next mystery. This is how we change the world. Chapter 2 For hours they walked on through the stifling humidity, too hot and miserable to speak. Chev struggled up steep slopes of stinking clay, trying to ignore the barbs and thorns that tore at her clothes and flesh. That same clay came in particularly useful when they passed a dozen blood wasp hives, smearing the stuff all over their bodies to avoid the insects' agonizing stings. Of course, once out of danger, they were forced to endure the itching as the stinking mess dried on their skin. Chev counted herself in good health, but soon even she was panting as she hacked her way through the tangled undergrowth. Howl kept close, as he always did, and she was uncomfortably aware of his dead-eyed gaze, despite the fact that she never turned to meet it. After some time, they heard the trickle of running water. Some of the others sighed in relief, and she heard the clinking of metal as they retrieved their flasks and water skins, hoping to refresh their dwindling supplies. Chev paused, hunched down, and surveyed their surroundings. The thickest of the jungle had recently given way to a sparse woodland, dotted with tall, thin blackwood trees. Purple and red leaves pooled around their ankles. They were traversing a shallow incline, at the foot of which ran a brook of crystal-clear water. The air was entirely still, quiet, save for the occasional avian trill. Too quiet. "Wait," she said softly. "We should take care here. Check the area before we..." Gwaiya, the big Saronite, shouldered her aside. His great bald dome of a head glistened in the sunlight, and he hefted his great poleaxe as he strode towards the stream, waterskin in hand.
"You wait," he growled. "We've been walking for days. We stop here and drink."
Several others followed him, stowing blades and black powder pieces. The Golden Lord appeared by her side, grasping his staff tightly. "You see something?" he asked. "No," Chev replied, frowning as she watched two cell swords laughing raucously and splashing water at each other. "But we should move away from here. This is the only source of water we've seen in 2 days. Every predator within 50 leagues will know of it."
"Nevertheless, we need water," said the masked man, addressing those who had stayed back. Many of the Golden Lord's band had learned to heed Chev's advice. "Let us refill our skins. But Madam Arklis is correct. Do not lower your guard." More men and women bounded down to the stream. The Golden Lord stayed at her side, however, observing from a distance. Chev's parched throat ached as she watched the cell swords gulp down handfuls of water. But she had long ago learned to trust her instincts, and right now every fiber of her being was screaming at her to leave this clearing. Two of the Golden Lord's men began to trudge back up the hill to rejoin the main group. They were chuckling at some joke and brushing the remnants of smeared clay from their bare arms. Out of the trees, a creature with a horned quadruped form barreled into them. Its horns locked under the first man's legs, and the huge gray-skinned beast bucked its head, sending him soaring a dozen feet into the air. It reared up and raked two great claws across the second man's chest. There was a spurt of crimson, and the unfortunate sellsword toppled to the ground, ribs exposed through his torn overshirt. The beast roared triumphantly. Beneath its horned brow was a broad, flat snout and a maw filled with jagged teeth. It was large, but not bulky, instead possessing the sleek muscles of a hunting feline. Several strange perforated chimneys made of bleached bone rose along its flank. They seemed to pulse with a dim orange light. A Brachytor, Chev realized with a shiver. She'd heard trackers speak of the beasts often, and always with a tone of dread.
"Don't get close to it," she shouted.
Gwaiya and his band already had their weapons in hand. If they heard her, they showed no sign of following her advice. They started to loose crossbow bolts at the creature, which pressed itself close to the ground, and then bounded into the stream, battering one unfortunate woman with its great curved horns. She flipped over in the air, then splashed into the water, and did not move. Gwaiya ducked the swipe of a clawed forelimb and hacked his poleaxe along the beast's flank. It screeched in pained fury as more cell swords darted in to score slashes across its hind legs. More warriors began to sprint down the slope towards the melee, sensing an easy kill and perhaps a chance to claim a trophy. They were almost upon it when the strange growths lining the beast's hide erupted, sending a great cloud of fiery dust into the air. The cell swords staggered to a halt. Gasping, they clawed at their eyes and throats. A number toppled to the ground, where they rolled and twitched as if struck by invisible blades. Then the screaming started. Gwaiya, who had been immediately beside the beast when it had released its spores, was the loudest. He dropped to the soil and curled into a fetal ball, his weapon forgotten, bellowing like a frightened auroch. The Brachytor lowered its head over the prone Serenite, and there was an audible crunch of bone. His screams cut off abruptly. "Please stay here, Madam Aklis," said the Golden Lord, hefting his staff. It was an unnecessary order. Chev had no intention of getting in that thing's way. As they watched, astonished, the masked man strode through the swirling spores, showing no sign of discomfort or pain. He stood there, amidst the orange haze, and slammed his staff upon the ground, once, twice, three times. The Brachytor raised its great head and growled. Its jaws were smeared with blood, and its eyes, small and beady in the center of that great maw, were pinpoints of blazing yellow. It sprang towards the Golden Lord, a flashing blur of grey. A dozen paces away, it leapt, soaring through the air, with its razor-edged claws outstretched. The Golden Lord moved with almost unnatural speed, raising his staff in two hands and shouting a single word in a language that Chev did not understand. The hairs on the back of her neck rose. There was a crack like a gunshot and a blinding flash of light. When Chev had finished blinking away the afterimage, she saw the small man standing there, totally unperturbed. The Brachytor was several feet away, slumped on its side, its grey hide blackened and scarred as if left to char on a fire. Wisps of smoke rose from its broken body. Chev carefully made her way towards the Golden Lord. He was leaning heavily on his staff, but otherwise seemed unharmed. He gazed at her as she approached. "Is it?" she began. "Quite dead, I assure you." She crept closer to the smoking body of the creature. Bones showed through its blasted flesh. She took in the great flat head, tipped with those curved horns, the teeth as big as daggers. "An extraordinary creature," said the Golden Lord, sounding entirely unimpressed. "It discharged some form of poison, yes? A method of debilitating its prey, I would assume."
"It's a powerful hallucinogenic," said Chev, running her hand across one of the Brachytor's strange growths and examining the powder-like substance that surrounded the polyps. Unable to resist, she pulled a small vial from her pocket and brushed some of the dust into it. Even from this distance, it had a powerful smell, like sulfur mixed with rotten meat. "I think it's more for defense," she continued. "It disorients and confuses attackers, letting the Brachytor escape."
"Which rather begs the question, what has such a remarkably dangerous specimen to fear?"
The groans and shrieks of the remaining stricken sellswords went suddenly quiet. Chev turned from the corpse of the beast and glanced back at the rest of their band. Howl stood next to one of the downed warriors, wiping blood from his blade. He glanced over and met her stare, utterly untroubled, as if he had just swatted a fly. She started forwards, but the Golden Lord laid a firm hand on her shoulder.
"Madam Aklis, we do not have the time or resources to care for the wounded."
"But
We can't just...
Their screams risk bringing more hostile creatures to our location, the masked figure continued. His voice was firm, and for the first time, she heard a hard, uncompromising edge to his words.
This is for the best. Carrying the wounded would simply endanger us all.
The Golden Lord nodded at Howl, and the sellsword bent down and drove his blade through the last of the twitching victims. The woman rasped a final breath and went limp. Chev wanted to vomit. She looked imploringly at the nearest sellswords, but saw nothing but grim resolve and indifference. No one else seemed to care at all that they had just killed 5 of their own.
Take their water skins, said the Golden Lord, before striding off and leaving the corpse-strewn stream behind. And leave the bodies. We've no time for looting. There will be more than enough compensation for you all once we reach Katzimos.
Howl gave Chev a black-toothed smirk before he and the others strode after their leader. Chev looked at the littered corpses, their glazed eyes staring sightlessly at the azure skies above, and then spun to follow. Chapter 3 They trudged onwards through the fading light, cursing and grunting as the land became rougher and steeper with every step. Chev could not dispel the image of Howl culling their injured companions from her head. In this job, it paid to be practical, she told herself. Truly, what could they have done? Dragged 6 mortally wounded souls through this death trap of a jungle? Or left them behind to suffer a slow and painful death, rotting in the heat like overripe fruit? The reality was, out here in the wilds, you had to accept a number of uneasy truths. It was better this way for everyone. So why did she feel so God's damned low?
My lord,
came a voice from way up ahead. It was Curd, one of their trackers, a thin, wiry Excelsian covered with tattoos. He carried a battered but well-crafted saber and a red and green checked sash that marked him as a former Free Guild man. How he'd come to be out here, she had no idea, but decided it was probably best not to ask.
I believe we've found it, he said softly, with wide eyes.
Chev bounded up the steep incline towards the man, zipping past several sellswords grappling with the tangled undergrowth. Clambering over the ridge, she saw what had taken Curd's breath away. Ahead of them, the ground fell away into a vast circular pit, a rent in the earth several 1,000 paces across. Shards of broken rock circled the rim of this crater, and limbs of ancient trees jutted out from the earth, dangling over the precipice like a giant's crooked fingers. At several points, streams of water poured over the edge, gleaming and glittering as they tumbled away into vast channels far below. The city of Katzimos spread out ahead of them, a sprawling ruin littered with shattered buildings, tumble-down spires, and great marble columns half-devoured by vines and creepers. At the rear of the canyon, the ground sloped away, disappearing into darkness. It was as if the earth had opened its maw to devour the city whole. Curd whistled softly.
That's a view you don't see every day.
Madam Arklis, I knew I was right to put my faith in you, said the Golden Lord, kneeling down beside them.
If he was at all tired from their long march, he showed no sign. He showed no outward sign of emotion either, but she could hear an excited tremor in his voice.
Katzimos, the fabled library city. I have searched for this place for a very long time. Let us see what secrets it conceals.
Several sellswords brought up silk-hemp ropes and grapples, and found a firmly lodged cluster of thick oaks that hung out into empty space over the drop. They looped and secured them with thick iron bands,
and several men and women strapped on gloves and boots tipped with thick metal spikes. Even Chev, no stranger to heights, felt her stomach swirl queasily as several of the climbers let themselves fall into empty space, dangling on harnesses and digging crampons into the face of the rock. The work was slow, but after a few hours the climbers made the pit's floor and signaled up that the line was secure. Chev didn't wait. She pushed forward to claim her spot on one of the lines, securing her belt to the rope with a clamp and strapping on a pair of fingerless auroch hide gloves. The sooner the descent was over, the better. She gritted her teeth, banished a sudden rush of vertigo, and slid over the precipice. Foot by foot, she descended. The crater's wall was rough and full of torn roots and gaping holes. Several times she reached for a grip, only to tear loose a cluster of soil and rocks, which tumbled away into the gloom below. A squat, oval-eyed lizard gazed at her disinterestedly as she lowered herself past its lair. "Sorry for the intrusion," she muttered. The lizard ran a long, blue-tipped tongue lazily over its eyeball. Suddenly, it disappeared in a snap of fangs and spurt of blood as something with too many eyes and stretching claws burst out from the darkness. Chev's heart somersaulted. She let out a squawk of horror and hurled herself to the side as the wall exploded in a shower of soil and gore. She dangled there, spinning and cursing, her heart hammering in her chest. Then the screams started. She glanced up and saw a sellsword scrabbling for his blade. He'd barely drawn metal when long barbed pincers reached out from the wall to snatch him away into darkness. His frenzied, awful screeches cut an icy hole into her heart until they abruptly cut off. Soil and rocks rained down into her hair and her eyes. Something fell past her, shrieking, close enough to make her ears ache. Desperately, she began to climb down. Abandoning caution for haste, she missed a grip and fell, scrabbling for a handhold. Her head struck something hard and stars exploded behind her eyes, but by some miracle, she managed to hold on to something firm and gnarled, jutting out of the wall. The impact sent a shock of pain up her arm, but she clung on, opening her eyes. A tree root. She wrapped herself around it, holding on to it like a shipwrecked sailor on a piece of driftwood. There was more screaming, and the snap-click of crossbow bolts thudding into solid surfaces. Blearily, she looked upwards and saw at least a dozen sellswords descending at speed as the cliff face erupted to life around them, insectile appendages darting out in search of prey. She had to get down. Below was only a long drop to certain death. Those fortunate few who'd managed to get down safely had crossbows and repeaters drawn, but what could they do, really? If they fired a hail of bolts, they'd be as likely to skewer their own as strike one of the creatures. Another cloud of sun-baked mud exploded outwards to Chev's left, and she caught sight of one of the beasts for the first time. It had a long, segmented body like a centipede, bedecked with barbed armor plates that shone razor-sharp in the sunlight. Its head was small, bulbous, like that of a spider, with hundreds of pitch-black eyes and a pair of snapping mandibles. Its forelegs were long, thin spears of jet-black chitin. It swept those enormous limbs around while a pair of curving antennae whipped at the air. She clutched her lifeline even harder, frozen in both terror and indecision. Yet even though she was only a few feet away, the beast did not seem to notice her. It was blind in the sunlight, she realized with a surge of relief. As long as she stayed corpse still, maybe she could survive this yet. The branch groaned beneath her, and there was a crack of splintering wood. Of course. With a shriek, the tunnel horror stabbed its claws out at the sudden sound. Chev rolled, hanging by her aching fingers underneath the drooping tree branch. She tugged at the rope secured to her belt. It was hopelessly tangled, pulled so taut that it was cutting into her stomach. All she could hear was the frenzied hissing of the tunnel horror and the thunk as its spear limbs thudded into the branch that held her. It swiped a leg across horizontally and snipped clean through the silkweave rope. The pressure on her abdomen was blissfully released. She fumbled, unhooking the slack, which fell away. Now at least she could move. Unfortunately, she was also now hanging free a few feet above cold, hard rock, with a frenzied monster doing its best to eviscerate her. First things first, she snapped her head around, looking for some escape. There, below her and to the left, was another jutting root, maybe large enough to hold her weight. Maybe not, of course, but Chev knew sometimes you had to take your chances. She waited until the thing had stopped thrashing, slipped her flask free from her pack, and hurled it over the monster's head and into the canyon wall. The tunnel horror whirled its many-eyed head about with a rattling hiss. Chev hauled herself up onto the branch, swaying as it dropped lower. It splintered, and she saw a jagged line zigzag down the length of the wood. The tunnel horror spun back around, its limbs raised high. Chev took a step and flung herself into space. Something whipped past her head close enough to brush her scalp. There was a moment of stomach-churning vertigo, and then she struck rock hard enough to blast all the air from her lungs, hard enough that she very nearly lost her grip entirely. Wheezing and spitting blood, she wrapped her legs around her new home. She lay there for a few blessed moments, whimpering softly, clutching her bruised ribcage. Then her new home started creaking too. Of course, she thought with a sigh. She dragged her aching bones upright, looking around desperately for another escape route. Below, possibly too far away for her to reach, was a pool of glittering green water covered with algae and drooping vines. It looked deep enough, but there was a good to fair chance it was merely disguising a cluster of sharp rocks. There was a chorus of hissing behind her, and two more insectoid monstrosities hauled their chitinous bodies free, antennae lashing, razor-tipped legs gleaming wetly in the fading light. That made her decision to jump much easier. She ran and leapt high into space, tucking her arms across her chest, pointing her toes, and screaming so loudly it hurt as she plummeted down. She struck the pool of water like an arrow. The chill made her reflexively gasp, and she swallowed a brackish mouthful. Her foot struck soft, muddy earth and stuck fast, and she kicked and struggled in panic, swallowing more water. Finally, her lungs burning, she tugged her foot free of the sucking morass and darted for the surface. One hand scrabbled for a hold, and she raised her head into daylight, spitting out the rancid liquid. Strong hands grasped her under the arms, and she felt herself being lifted free of the pool. She blinked foul-smelling water out of her eyes, and a figure swam into focus. Curd, he was shaking his head.
Sigma's teeth, he said with a chuckle. You're a mad one, elf. You're goddamned lucky you didn't splatter all over the flagstones. Every inch of me hurts, she groaned. Yeah, well, it could have been worse, he replied.
She hauled her aching body to its knees and looked around. Barely 20 souls remained of their brave fellowship, and at least a couple of them were sporting deep lacerations across their arms and chests. She was irritated to see that Howl was one of the survivors, though she noted he was nursing a nasty gash across his upper arm and grimacing in pain. The tunnel horrors had disappeared back into their lairs, presumably having gorged themselves to their satisfaction. Chev decided not to think about how in the eight realms they were going to make it back up that cliff face later. The Golden Lord was there, somehow unharmed and barely out of breath. He muttered an arcane phrase, and the tip of his staff began to glow with a soft yellow light, bathing the weathered stones beneath their feet in a warm amber haze. The ground on which they stood sloped away into a wide avenue, which led further into the ruins.
We are near, he said. Follow me.
They began to walk down what was once a central thoroughfare and now a stretch of broken flagstones lined with toppled statues, invaded on all fronts by thick, barbed gorse and patches of yellow-green grass. The statues were of men, elves, and Duardin, but not warriors or rulers as you might expect from a city this size. All of them bore the trappings of inventors and scholars. A man reaching out towards the heavens, a bizarre mechanical contraption in one hand, wearing what seemed to be a pair of many-lensed goggles. There was an elf, wielding nothing more than a long-feathered quill, a look of intense concentration upon his angular face, slightly ruined now by the smears of verdigris that covered his body like a rash.
"I don't think it was a battle that caused all this," Chev said, wondering aloud. "There's no sign of weapons, no skeletons lying in piles on the streets."
"I would estimate this city to have had a population in the low thousands," said the Golden Lord. "It is indeed strange to see so few remains. Most likely Kadzimos was abandoned."
"If so, what caused them to leave?"
"Let us continue on. Perhaps we may find answers within."
The Golden Lord kept up a fearsome pace, hardly caring to take in the wonders that surrounded them. That seemed strange to her, considering how effusive he had been about discovering this place. Perhaps the dangers they had already faced had robbed him of his excitement. They continued on, tramping over scattered masonry, shards of age-old glass and broken pottery. All around them was the spectre of destruction. Entire avenues of columned halls lay crumpled and crushed, as if they were the abandoned playthings of some vast titan. After what seemed like several hours of travel, Howl held up a hand.
"Listen," he growled,
kneeling to press one hand to the ground. They fell silent, weapons drawn, gazing around at the ghost of Kadzimos uneasily. The light was fading now, and shadows crept from doors and hallways like questing fingers. After a moment, Chev could hear the sounds. Drums, beating to a frenzied staccato rhythm. Low, guttural sounds like bellowed chants. They were only a few hundred paces from the far side of the canyon now. The sheer cliff face rose above them at an angle, and the city descended beneath it into darkness. It was as if the earth itself was opening its jaws to devour Kadzimos, and the ruins of the city were sliding slowly down its gullet.
"We're going down there," said Howl.
Even the old mercenary's voice was hesitant.
"We are,"
said the Golden Lord, who showed no sign of fear or trepidation. He might as well have been announcing a camping trip.
"You heard the drums," said Howl. "There's something down there."
"Then we shall take great pains to avoid it, if it poses a threat to us. We have suffered greatly to get here, my friends, but we have made it. Within lies our fortune, if we only have the fortitude to seize it. Are you with me?"
There was a mumbled sound of assent, decisive, if not particularly enthusiastic. Chapter 4.
"Well, that complicates things," said Chev, staring down at the clusters of roaring fires in the clearing below.
Hulking figures whirled and bellowed around the flames, casting flickering shadows across the ground. Their skin was dark green, covered with thick smears of war paint in all colors, while they carried crude clubs or axes made of chipped stone. Around these capering figures loomed the broken spires of the shattered city, great arcing gateways rent and torn, the skeletons of burned-out towers and piles of scattered rubble. The Aurochs had found Kadzimos, and they had indulged their passion for thoughtless destruction on this ancient place of learning. The light of their roaring fires danced across the cavernous ceiling of the chamber, high above their heads.
"They have been here for many years,"
said the Golden Lord, kneeling beside her. This devastation is decades old, perhaps centuries old. Leering, bestial faces were carved into the walls in this corner of the city, and great totems of bone littered the chamber, painted garishly with lurid color. The place stank of sweat and filth.
"More and more of them every season," said Howl, spitting in disgust. "Come pouring out of the jungles, chanting like mad folk. Port Krassin fell not 2 months past, burned to ashes."
"The Men of Lightning defeated them at the Battle of Blistersand,"
said one of the Golden Lord's hirelings, a pockmarked youth named Fegel, with an air of sage wisdom.
"They killed an auroch the size of a mountain, so they did. My uncle told me he fought there."
Howl snorted.
"Your uncle's a drunk or a liar. Besides, there ain't no defeating greenskins, not for long. You just kill as many as you can. Enough that they don't rise up again for a good long time."
"There must be 100 of those creatures down there," muttered Chev.
"Then we are fortunate we have not stumbled upon a full war party, armed and ready for slaughter," said the Golden Lord. "And we can avoid them."
"You think Ecclesius's tomb still stands?"
asked Chev.
"It must,"
the masked man snapped. Chev raised an eyebrow. It was the first time she had heard him lose his composure. He shook his head and glanced at her.
"I apologize, Madam Arklis," he said. "It is simply that we are so close to our goal, and to be foiled in our quest now would be the harshest of punishments. Please enlighten me. Where do you believe the tomb is located?"
She turned and scanned the encampment below. The auroch's fires occupied a central square, what she assumed would once have been a plaza or some kind of forum. The buildings had once been impressive structures, towering spires and great archways of gleaming marble. Most had been leveled long ago, torn down and claimed by the ravenous wilderness. Yet not all had suffered such a fate. Far across the way, beyond the hollering bands of aurochs, stood a building larger than any other. It was tall and angular, in the style of many Sigmarite cathedrals she had seen, but there was a wide range of clashing architectural styles visible even through the damage it had suffered. Sweeping buttresses supported a central spire, which tapered to an iridescent spiral of dully gleaming crystal. The windows were circular portals in the fashion of the ancient Asmahari churches. They were almost all smashed. The roof, meanwhile, seemed oddly organic, an almost chitinous shell of disc-shaped tiles arrayed in yet more spiral patterns. There were many gaping holes in the building, and the main archway lay shattered and broken on the steps leading to the main entrance, but the place retained a sort of tragic grandeur, despite the savage desolation around it.
"If I know anything about Ecclesius, it's that for all his genius, the man was monumentally self-obsessed," she began. "There's no way he would opt for a quaint, quiet burial place."
She gestured to the grand building across the way.
"I bet 100 gulden that we'll find his mausoleum in there."
"I concur," said the Golden Lord. "Let us be cautious lest we bring the aurochs down upon us."
He turned and gestured their band forwards. Howl led them down the nearest incline, a steep ravine that dropped between the spines of 2 broken buildings, crafted from green-black stone. Everyone had their weapons drawn, a wicked assortment of blades of all shapes and sizes. Some carried crossbows and alley pieces, but all those who bore firearms kept them tucked in their belts and holsters. A single shot here would bring hordes of greenskins down upon their heads. The drums of the aurochs were like a hammer in their skulls, and their stamping feet seemed to echo around every corner. Silhouettes leapt and spun across the dusty road ahead as they crept ever closer to the auroch war camp. They could hear the creatures' idiot howls and the clash of weapons, and see glimpses of their bodies through the skeletons of the ruined buildings. Ahead, the cover of the ruins broke for a dozen or so paces, and to their left they could see the Auruk's camp. In groups of two or three, they dashed across the open ground, fortunately bathed in shadows now in the receding light. Dozens of Auruks were slumbering next to crude huts fashioned from cured skins and bound bone. These lairs were festooned with skulls and rib cages, some human, but mostly the large, broad bones of fellow Auruks, victims from an opposing tribe, no doubt. Other greenskins still capered, swirling around the campfires in their insane dance. It should, perhaps, have been a ridiculous sight, but their muscular, war-painted bodies and totems of bleached bone gave their display a kind of primal ferocity. As Chev watched, a fight broke out, and two enormous warriors began to clash their heads together violently, blood spurting from their brows and noses as they battered each other senseless to jeers of their kin. Ahead, a Kismanite, with a short hunting spear and a forked beard bound with brass rings, was gesturing furiously at her to move. She slipped out from the ruins' shelter and skittered across the open ground, rolling into the shadows on the far side of the clearing. Her heart was hammering in her chest, but the Auruks seemed oblivious to their presence still. Ahead loomed the great central tower. They drifted through the campfire light cautiously, approaching the structure. Howl was leading, and even Chev had to begrudgingly admit that the killer knew his trade. Despite his age, he moved with agile grace, hardly making a sound. As they neared the broken steps leading up to the ruined gatehouse, he dropped low and raised a hand sharply to signal them to halt. They crouched low, blades and bows ready. Ahead, two Auruks rounded the corner, stumbling and teetering, clutching spears that ended in heavy, jagged shards of black stone. They were clearly inebriated, grunting at each other in their harsh tongue. They were perhaps 20 paces away, and getting closer.
"Fill 'em full of bolts," growled Hal. "You lot, with me. We'll finish 'em off."
A trio of leather-jerkined Excelsians crept forward, aiming heavy repeaters at the oncoming Auruks. Others lifted bows, throwing axes, and javelins. They waited until the creatures were only a dozen yards distant, still growling and spitting at each other. Hal swung his hand down sharply, like an executioner's axe. There was a chorus of clicks, then thrumming strings as the archers released. Perhaps a score of bolts and missiles thudded into the greenskins. They grunted as the deadly torrent struck home, pitching them backwards. One twitched briefly, then lay still. The other roared in confused anger and staggered upright. Riddled with bolts, he brandished his spear. Howl was already moving, along with five other killers. They leapt on the remaining Auruk, bearing him to the ground under sheer weight of numbers, though the bulky creature did not go down easily. One great hand snapped out to close around the throat of a sellsword, even as the others drove knives and axes into the Auruk's torso again and again. The creature's crude spear jerked out, and Chev saw it punch right through the unfortunate man's chest and through his thin chain surcoat. He gurgled and spat blood, and his two daggers clattered to the floor. But the Auruk's fury and impressive constitution could not save it. Howl rammed his saw-toothed blade under the beast's chin, and its bloodshot eyes rolled up in its head. With a gurgling spasm, the creature finally became still. They all tensed, waiting for the inevitable shouted alarms. The killing had been quick, but hardly quiet. Chev tensed, ready to flee into the darkness. But no cry of warning was heard, no sounds of running feet. She breathed a sigh of relief. Howl and his surviving sellswords dragged the bodies behind a pile of rubble, including that of the unfortunate sellsword. Chev watched the killer with disdain as he rifled through the slain man's clothes, pocketing a few copper coins and trinkets. Their bloody task complete, they moved on, breaking across open ground and racing up the steps to the ruined building, ducking into the safety of its shadowed hall.
"Torches!" hissed the Golden Lord.
A flickering orange glow lit up the hall as several sellswords lit pitch-soaked brands or activated flare stones. It revealed an utterly ruined chamber, blackened by fires and covered in scattered debris. Once, white marble statuary and great spherical glass cases had filled this entrance hall, populated with all manner of tomes and artifacts. Those relics had been smashed and torn apart, hurled across the room or burned. Holes were smashed in the walls and in the arched ceiling high above. Spears of twilight illuminated gleaming shards of broken glass and crystal. Red-brown stains, perhaps dried blood or something even more repulsive, were smeared across every surface, along with crude, scrawled depictions of slaughter and bloodshed, watched over by the greenskins' savage gods. Shev's heart sank to see such thoughtless, pointless destruction. How many secrets were contained within these walls, echoes of civilization and culture now lost forever? Two great antechambers branched off from this great hall, both of which were in the same sorry state. In the corner of one was a pile of fractured skulls and skeletons. Shev knelt down to examine them. They were mostly human, but there were some elves and duardin bones too. There were scraps of fabric, decayed and faded by time, but with a hint of elaborate embroidery. These, she presumed, had once been the guardians or resident scholars of this place, trapped and slaughtered by the aurochs or some other intruder many centuries ago.
"No tombs here,"
came Howl's voice, echoing despite his hushed tones.
"And no treasures either. Damned aurochs have had their fun and there ain't nothing left for us."
The Golden Lord turned to gaze at Shev. She shook her head.
"I'm telling you, Ecclesius is here somewhere," she said. "We're missing something."
"If you've led us all out here for nothing, I'll gut you myself," hissed a grey-haired woman, wielding a wide-bladed coppice.
"Leave you to the greenskin's mercy."
"Silence," barked the Golden Lord. "Spread out and check every inch of this place, every wall, every corner. Go."
The sellswords filtered off into the gloom, leaving Shev and the masked man behind. His blank mask was still fixed upon her.
"Madam Arklis," he said, "I hope you realize the gravity of the situation. I promised these men and women great rewards for accompanying me here under your guidance. Should we emerge empty-handed, they will desire retribution, and I will be unable to sway them from that purpose."
"Ecclesius rests here," she said firmly, before striding away.
It had taken years for her to pin down the location of Katzimus, from fragments of ancient texts, maps, and spoken legends. Trying to piece together the history of the mortal realms was like grasping at smoke. So much had been lost in the horror of the Great Darkness, when demon kind had rampaged across the lands, slaughtering and despoiling all in their path. Entire cultures and continent-spanning empires had been brought to their knees, their monuments torn down and their great works of art and literature destroyed or consumed by fire. Little oral history remained, for the citizens of these once proud kingdoms were either butchered or forced to join the dark god's mortal legions, devolving into little more than sadistic killers. Only amidst the ruins of murdered civilizations could scraps of the truth be found. Shev had travelled far and wide across the beast lands, seeking out forgotten tombs, lost cities, and hidden repositories, piecing together a fractured history of this dangerous land. She had walked within the prism city of Glaur, waded through the flooded catacombs of Mikramikai, and breached the sky vaults of the Cloud Kingdoms. In all those places, she had found traces of the great Ecclesius, traveller and statesman, inventor and philosopher. He had been welcomed as a hero wherever he roamed, granted the greatest honours and showered with gifts and accolades. Katzimus had been his home. and it seemed as though the ancient city had maintained strong trade routes and alliances with almost every major kingdom in this region. Experts from the city were valued as greatly as the mightiest warriors. Depicted in great murals leading the construction of wondrous monuments and monolithic statues in honor of the gods. And then, in the blink of an eye, all that grandeur had been torn down, trampled, and burned. As she crept through the dusty halls, the light from her torch illuminated ancient frescoes and murals, most of which had been smashed or scarred so badly they were no longer decipherable. She entered the great hall and gazed up at the ceiling, barely visible in the gloom. There was something up there, poking out of the darkness. A great hanging ornament, trailed by cobwebs and ghostly white with dust. But unlike everything else in this place, it was largely intact. From a central disc of dull metal, broad enough for a person to walk along its length with ease, dangled 6 globes. Now she looked closer, she could see flickers of color beneath the patina of dust. Clambering up a nearby column, she leapt across and grasped a handhold on a cluster of burned bookcases that were leaning against one another precariously. From there, she could reach a thin ledge that ran around the edge of the chamber. She hoisted herself up and turned to face the device.
"What are you up to now?"
shouted Curd from below. She grinned down at him.
"Exploring," she said,
and jumped from the ledge across to the hanging ornament. The entire thing groaned, swaying under her weight. For a moment she wondered if she had misjudged this horribly. A cloud of dust erupted from the hanging globes, drifting out over the chamber like a miniature sandstorm. She climbed onto the central disc and examined the structure. A track wound its way around the ornament in concentric loops. Each of the hanging orbs was attached to one of these tracks. She felt a tremor of excitement. She heard footsteps below and saw the Golden Lord and several other sellswords approach.
"The Liber Celestium tells us that there are 8 spheres of creation," she told her audience, gesturing to the hanging ornament. "Akshi, Realm of Fire." She pointed to a red-gold orb covered with rivulets of red crystal that shimmered like trails of lava. "Gyron, Realm of Life." The jade orb, bright and vigorous even in the gloom of the chamber. "Haish, Realm of Light, and Ulgu, Realm of Shadows. Diametrically opposed, yet inextricably linked, they orbit one another, unable to escape each other's pull."
She reached down, tugged at the chains that connected these 2 spheres. She rotated them to the right so that they nestled next to one another. As she did so, they began to glow with a faint light.
"Gur, Realm of Beasts. Chamon, Realm of Metal," whispered the Golden Lord, shaking his head. "To think I missed this." "You said 8 spheres," said Hal. "There's only 6.
Shev laughed and pointed a finger at the ceiling.
"Holy Azir, domain of the God King," she said. "It sits at the apex of the firmament, watching over all."
A column of luminescence rose from the twin orbs of light and shadow. It bathed the walls of the structure in soft golden light. Above, in the angular recess of the building's roof, loomed an engraving of a flaming comet. As the light found it, it gleamed white-hot, so bright it almost hurt to look upon.
"And below it all, Shaish," said the Golden Lord, "the realm of death, the land of endings."
He rapped his stave on the floor of the sanctuary, which began to glow with amethyst light. The floor creaked, and several startled sellswords leapt out of the way as a great aperture yawned open beneath them. An avalanche of dust toppled away into the darkness, and by the flickering torchlight, they could see a stairway spiraling down. The steps were exquisitely carved from obsidian, through which ran veins of gleaming azure. Shev punched the air, unable to help herself. She felt that familiar shiver of anticipation run down her spine, and suddenly all the slog and toil of the past few years faded into insignificance. Before her companions could even react, she was bounding down the stairs, an eager grin on her face. Chapter 5. The stairway wound down perhaps a couple of hundred paces before ending at an archway of white marble. She wondered at the stonework. Images and icons had been worked into the structure and inlaid with gold and silver, soaring sail arcs drifting over a jagged mountain range, a city built within a molten waterfall, primordial monuments of forgotten gods beneath the waves, a clockwork metropolis populated by masked, robed figures, places and realms that Ecclesius had visited, perhaps, scattered memories from an extraordinary life. The room beyond the archway was a circular chamber lit by several braziers that still smoldered with a pale blue light. Every inch of the room was covered in yet more frescoes, so many wondrous sights and images that she barely knew where to look. Three mirrors were placed at equal distances around the edges of the chamber, reaching almost to the ceiling. In the center of the room, on a raised dais, was a large block of grey-white stone. Resting atop this oblong was a golden statue laid lengthwise. It was a man, dressed in long robes and wearing a skull cap, his eyes closed in repose, his hands crossed over his chest. In one hand he carried a small circular device, a globe crisscrossed by bands of silver. In the other he clutched an eyeglass. After all these years, she had found it. The resting place of Ecclesius the Realms Walker. She thought of her father, the mortal who had adopted her, and felt a stab of sadness that she could not share this wondrous discovery with him. An explorer and cartographer of no small renown, Dedrick Reinheim, had passed nearly half a century ago, yet the wound was still raw. Footsteps echoed behind her. She turned to see the Golden Lord enter the chamber, flanked by a dozen mercenaries. He barely stopped to look at the wondrous carvings, but instead simply marched across the room to the coffin. "You cannot know how long I have striven to find this place," he muttered. "So much I have sacrificed to be here now. So much I have lost." With a triumphant growl, he raised his staff and brought it crashing down upon the lid of the coffin. There was a resounding crack, and the marble splintered and came apart. "What are you doing?" gasped Chev, appalled at such carelessness. Not that she was averse to rooting through the treasures of the long dead, but she believed you were supposed to do it with at least a certain amount of finesse. He ignored her. Several of his hirelings approached, and together they hauled the heavy marble lid of the coffin loose. It fell to the floor of the chamber with a crash, releasing a cloud of dust. Chev moved closer and peered into the sarcophagus, her heart thumping. There lay Ecclesius. She thought for a queasy moment that he was alive. Though the corpse's skin was pale and stretched, his hair frayed and his teeth yellowed, the preservation of the body was remarkable. Even his eyes remained intact, piercing blue orbs that gazed contentedly off into nothing. In repose, he was a nondescript man, quite unlike the illustrations and depictions that she had seen of the great Realms Walker. He was small and shaven-headed, with a wispy little beard and a weak chin. Time had worn his skin to a grey sheen. His bald pate was heavily liver-spotted, indicating a life spent out under the sun. His clothes were fine silk of a vibrant turquoise, and he wore several rings and bracelets of impressive craftsmanship, bejeweled and gleaming. Around his neck was a chain of silver, from which hung an amber claw sigil. It was decidedly odd,
looking into the face of someone you had spent years studying and researching. For all that time, the Realmswalker had been little more than a name on a page, a thread connecting her to the mysteries of the past. Looking into that coffin was like gazing upon history itself. Clutched in the arms of the corpse was a silver-bound tome, its surface filigreed with runes and markings she could not decipher. The Golden Lord wrenched the tome from the dead man's grasp.
The collected writings and memories of Ecclesius of Asiltane, the Realm's Walker, the Golden Lord whispered. At long last.
Shev gazed into the eyes of the dead man. She frowned. There was something strange about the man's crystal blue orbs. The right was milky and glazed, while the left seemed sharper, glimmering in the torchlight. She reached out and tapped it with her finger. It was hard, clicking at the touch of her fingernail. She glanced around. The Golden Lord was engrossed in the tome, not even looking in her direction.
It must be here, he muttered. It must.
She had no idea what he was talking about. The cell swords were eyeing the frescoes and golden filigrees of the tomb, no doubt wondering if anything in here could be easily looted. Fishing a small knife from her belt, Shev delicately pried the orb out of its socket. It popped out easily, and she palmed it. It was indeed a crystal, fashioned in the image of an eyeball. Upon further inspection, she could see small trails of silver light whirling and coalescing within the iris, casting a faint light across her palm. Odd. As she watched, the streams of light grew brighter and more insistent, the crystal flaring in her hand like the thorax of a glowfly. She stared into its depths, almost hypnotized by the mesmerizing patterns. There was something there, in the depths. She peered closer.
You know, in many cultures it is considered the height of rudeness to break into a man's tomb and start digging the eyes from his sockets.
Shev gave a startled yelp and dropped the crystal, which bounced hard on the edge of the coffin and rolled across the floor.
Will you please be more careful with that? Said the voice in her head, with an air of extreme irritation. It was incredibly difficult to attain, and if it breaks, there is no telling what will happen to me.
The Golden Lord rapped his staff upon the floor. He was staring at her from across the chamber.
What did you do? He said. His voice was ice cold.
Shev struggled for words.
She began.
I do not like this one's tone, said the voice in her head.
What? She gasped.
He's trouble, believe me. At my age, you get a sixth sense for these kind of things.
Stop it!
She shouted, clutching her head as if she could squeeze the unwelcome intrusion out of her skull.
What in the name of Sigmar is going on?
Tell me now, growled the Golden Lord. Oh, how rude of me. Allow me to introduce myself. Ecclesius of Asiltane, at your service, my lady, said the voice. Or at least as much as a disembodied consciousness can be. I am sorry, I have had precious few intelligent conversations in the past few hundred years. I fear I am going somewhat peculiar.
Peculiar? She sputtered. Who are you speaking to? Snapped the Golden Lord. Answer me.
She backed away, but someone grabbed her from behind. She smelt that familiar, pungent stench, and knew it was Howl. She struggled, but he twisted her arm painfully, locked her in place. The Golden Lord strode over to her, his staff grasped in two hands.
You will tell me what happened now, he growled, or I will allow Howl here to begin his work. I have witnessed the results of his art, Madam Arklis, and I have no wish to see them practiced upon you. So speak.
There was a voice in my head, she gasped, nodding to the crystal that lay dormant on the floor. That thing, it was speaking to me.
The Golden Lord strode over to the orb. He knelt down to inspect it, then reached out a hand, slowly, to grasp it.
Could it be?
He muttered to himself. Shade glass, taken from the haunted city of mirrors.
Now I understand. Our great thinker could not bear to enter the lands of the dead, not with so many sights left to see. No, he sought to exist beyond the grasp of the tyrant of bones.
The Golden Lord stood, grasping the orb tightly in one fist.
Listen to me, Ecclesius, he said. Do not address the girl, but speak to me alone. How long have you dwelt here, amidst the rubble of your life's work? Hundreds of years, at the very least. I can help you, Realmswalker. I can take you from this place, free you from the prison you have made for yourself. There are ways, my friend, ways to restore you to life. All I ask in return is this. Tell me where to find the silver shard.
There was a rustling sound, like the brushing of a soft hand over silk. Shev thought she saw a flicker of movement within the mirror to her left.
The silver shard, said the voice of the realm's walker.
By the way the Golden Lord's head twitched and the mercenaries jumped in shock, Shev was sure they all had heard it too this time. He sounded cautious, perhaps even afraid.
How do you know of that name? My reasons are my own, the Golden Lord continued. I know you traveled to the lost city of Zoantica, Ecclesius. I know that you alone returned from an expedition of 500 souls. Tell me where it lies.
I know not, said the voice. I cannot tell you, for the memories are lost to me. Only a shadow remains, the echo of a nightmare I cannot recall.
Try, said the masked man. There are worse fates than death, Realmswalker, and I will subject you to them all if you do not tell me what I wish to know.
All I know is that death surrounds this silver shard. Abandon your quest, masked one.
I tire of this, said the Golden Lord.
He hurled the orb to the floor, and it skittered across the stones. Then he raised his staff, which crackled and spat arcs of lightning.
What are you doing? Cried the voice of Ecclesius.
If you do not tell me how to find Zoantica, I will shatter this crystal. What will happen to your spirit, I wonder, when I break the cage that holds it? Perhaps you will travel to the underworld, and the great necromancer will finally get his due. Let us find out.
He aimed the tip of the staff at the crystal and unleashed a stream of crackling energy. Green smoke began to rise from the sparking orb.
No, you cannot do this.
Of course I can, said the Golden Lord, continuing to pour lightning into the relic.
There was a high-pitched shriek that echoed around the chamber, a disembodied sound of pure agony.
If you destroy me, I cannot give you the answers you seek.
Then I will find them another way. I am a patient man, Realmswalker. I have nothing but time. You, on the other hand, are swiftly running out.
The screams continued. Shev twisted free of Howl's grip.
Stop, she said, moving to the Golden Lord and reaching out a hand to grab his arm.
He pushed her away indifferently. The lightning was blinding now. It rippled across the roof of the chamber, and a cascade of dust poured down from the shuddering roof of the tomb.
I will tell you nothing, came the voice, sounding pained and thin.
You will tell me everything, snarled the masked man.
He touched the tip of his staff to the crystal. There was another burst of electricity, and Shev heard a crack, like splintering stone.
Far to the north! Please, I am not ready for death. There is so much yet to learn. travel to the farthest reaches of the Talon coast, where the mountains drift far above the earth.
The Fate Scar Mountains, the Golden Lord said. I know of this place. Continue.
Hidden in the highest peaks is a city named Zoantica. It is shielded from mortal eyes by illusion and magic. That is all I can remember. Only death lies within that place. I promise you that. If you enter, you will not leave.
The Golden Lord's spell ended abruptly. The floor was charred and smoking, and the crystal orb glowed bright like a hot ember. Allow me to worry about that, he said. He bent and picked up the blazing crystal in one gauntleted hand. You merely have to worry about guiding me there.
I am speaking to you alone now, elf,
came the Realmswalker's voice, low and urgent and pained.
This man will lead you to your death. You must escape as soon as you can, and take me with you. This man cannot be allowed to find Zoantica. Please.
Madam Arklis, said the Golden Lord, turning to her, I want to thank you for taking me this far. Without your assistance, I may never have found this tomb. And yet, I am now faced with a dilemma. You are in the unfortunate position of knowing too much about my intended destination. I wonder, can I trust you to keep my secrets? I am not a trusting man by nature.
Someone stepped in close and grabbed her by the arm. She felt the edge of a blade in the small of her back. She could tell by the rush of stale breath that it was Howl. Shev's eyes darted to the stairs. Two sellswords, Curd and a lean spearwoman, stood guard there. The Golden Lord sighed and held up a hand.
Please, do not be foolish, he said. Even without the ministrations of Mr. Howl, you would not make it more than 20 paces. Honestly, I'm not some mindless savage. I do genuinely appreciate your skills and your knowledge of the Talon Coast. You are a uniquely gifted woman, Shevanya.
You lied to me, she said. All this time, all this nonsense you spouted, and you're nothing but a petty thief after some magical trinket.
You knew I was no historian, no scholar. I never even played the part with any relish. I happen to be very skilled at deception. But the truth is that with you, it was never called for. Don't lie to yourself, Shevanya. You are not in this trade for anything but your own sense of adventure. Tell me how many great discoveries you have presented to the colleges of Azir? How many of your expeditions have been authorized and funded by the proper authorities? The truth is that you are a tomb robber and an exceptionally gifted one. Embrace that. I could use your skills.
Shev said nothing. His words were close, so close, to those her father had spoken the last time they had argued. Before he had died and left her alone in that silent house, alone with her memories and her regret. The masked man sighed and waved Howl back with an impatient gesture. The old killer loosened his grip, but she could feel him poised, waiting for an excuse to strike.
I am sorry I led you here under false pretenses. I would rather keep you at my side than have to resort to a more unpleasant option. I believe that we can achieve great things together.
It might have been the unsubtle threat that finally made up her mind. Perhaps it was the way that the Golden Lord's men slowly moved to block the exits. Either way, she decided it was time for her to dissolve this partnership. She had one chance, maybe, to take them by surprise. Her hand went to her pocket and closed around a flat disc of cold metal, a trinket of Duardin manufacture that she had reserved especially for moments of great need, such as this.
Very well, she said, stepping forward with one hand outstretched, the other clenched in a fist at her side. Let's find this silver shard of yours together. The Golden Lord reached out his hand to shake hers. She hurled the metal disc to the floor, raising an arm to shield her eyes. The chamber exploded with light and noise, a thunderous crack of silver-blue lightning that blasted them all from their feet and left a vicious ringing in their ears. The three mirrors shattered as one, sending shards of glass whipping across the chamber. Howl released his grip on her arm, and Chev snapped an elbow back into his nose, feeling a satisfying crunch as it struck home. She was on her feet in a moment. Around her, the Golden Lord's sellswords rolled and cursed in a daze. The Golden Lord was on his knees, hands covering his face. His mask lay scarred and smoking on the floor. He glanced towards her, and beneath the web of his fingers, she saw something writhe and blink. Not human eyes, not eyes at all, in fact. If there were any lingering doubts about abandoning this expedition, they evaporated in an instant. He turned away, grabbing for his mask. The crystal spilled from his grasp and skittered across the floor towards her, and she bent and scooped it up.
Miss Arklis, is it?
Came the voice in her head again.
May I suggest a swift egress?
Chev spun on her heel towards the entrance to the tomb. There was Curd, staggering to his feet, sword in hand. She bounded over to him, dodging around his clumsy attempt to grab her, and sank her knee into his groin. He folded with a groan, and she pushed him aside, feeling only the slightest hint of guilt. Compared to the rest of them, Curd really wasn't such a bad sort. And then she was free, bursting up the stairs into the gloom of the cathedral. Chapter 6. As she emerged from the tomb and started forwards, two sellswords came around the corner to bar her path, weapons raised, staring in confusion. The sound of clattering footsteps echoed up from below. She spun on her heels and ran in the other direction, darting off into the darkness, her former companions close behind. She pounded through a door at the far side of the hall, entering a corridor lined with shattered marble busts. After several yards, the corridor opened out into a vast hall filled with looming statues and row upon row of stacked tomes, stretching up into the gloom of the arched ceiling. As Chev darted between the closest opening, there was a deafening blast, and a stack of yellowed, curling scrolls to her left exploded in a cloud of choking dust. She could hear muttered curses behind her, echoing across the open chamber.
No guns, fool! You'll bring the whole cursed place down on us,
someone barked. Howl, perhaps. Well, that was something, Chev thought. Her relief lasted a scant few moments. Crossbow bolts slammed into the bookcases and display cases around her as she wheeled around a tight corner. Loud, but nowhere near as deafening as the gunshot, glass shattered and another cloud of dust erupted into the air. Someone had themselves a repeater bow.
Left, the path to your left,
said the voice of Ecclesius. More and more voices echoed around the great hall now, as Howl's sellswords filtered into the maze of bookshelves, hoping to cut off her escape. She had to get out of here before they surrounded her. As she pelted down another long corridor, more bolts skipped and deflected off the stone floor. Something whipped past her cheek, close enough to singe her hair. Two figures stepped out ahead of her at the end of the channel, a burly woman armed with a wicked silver steel mace, and a sallow man wielding a hooked dagger. Chev kept running, and they rushed to meet her. At the last moment, Chev shifted her momentum, leapt out to the right, and caught a foothold on the nearest shelf. As the woman swung her mace diagonally across, missing her by several blessed inches, Chev planted her other boot on the sellsword's face, feeling a satisfying crunch as her heel squashed the woman's nose flat. She kicked off, launching herself high over the remaining mercenary's trailing dagger, landing cat-like high up on the far bookcase, scrambling and hauling herself up as more bolts thudded around her.
She was just hauling herself over the lip of the case when something slammed into her shoulder, pitching her forward. Agony rippled down her left arm, and she lost her grip and tumbled over the far side of the rack, grabbing futilely at anything within reach as she went. Her fingers closed around a cluster of books, but the paper tore at her touch, and she only succeeded in pulling them down with her. She struck the stone floor with enough force to blast the breath from her body, and her jaw bounced hard, sending her head spinning. Spitting blood, she hauled herself to her knees. Despite the chaos and shouting around her, she spared a moment to collate her various agonies. Jaw, possibly broken. Ankle, little more than a ball of pain. At least two ribs fractured. And a headache, like she'd spent the last fortnight swigging Duardin fire whiskey. Oh, and the crossbow bolt, buried in her shoulder. She reached back and tugged out the barb, which took a chunk of flesh with it. The pain almost dropped her to her knees again. What a joyous day this was turning out to be.
"Where now?"
she said, throwing the bloody shard away.
"The statue," said the voice in her head. "Climb the statue at the end of the hall. There is a window there at the very top which should take you safely outside."
"Should?"
she said.
"Well, it's been quite some time, but as far as I can remember, the fall should not be lethal."
She sighed and glanced around, blurrily. There was thick stone at her back, the outer wall of the reliquary, to her left and right more bookcases, and ahead a statue of a winged creature in flight, half draconic, half leonine. Above this marble sculpture was a small arc of violet stained glass, bathing the nearby walls and floor in a haze of purple. More voices reverberated around her. It was hard to pick them out above the ringing in her ears, but it sounded like they were getting closer with every moment. Chev rushed forward, staggered on her injured ankle, but hobbled on, making for the statue. Howl stepped out in front of the statue. He had a loaded hand crossbow aimed at her in one hand and carried his saw-bladed cleaver in the other. His injured shoulder was bound with dirty bandages.
"No sneaking away this time, girl," he said, shaking his head.
She lowered one hand to her belt.
Ah,
he said, brandishing the alley piece, barbed bolt nestled in the groove. She sighed and raised her hands. He came closer, within a few feet. With a smile, he slowly lowered the hand bow and spun his blade in one hand.
"I'm going to enjoy this," he hissed, raising the blade.
Chev stepped forward and blew a handful of gleaming powder into his face. Howl cursed and screeched, swinging the knife blindly with one hand, clawing at his eyes with the other. Chev let the blade whistle past her neck, then stepped in close and brought her knee up between Howl's legs. He groaned, then slumped to the floor, twitching with drool spilling from his mouth. Chev grabbed the hand bow from his belt and pressed it to the back of Howl's head, into his greasy mop of grey-black hair.
"I should put a bolt in your head, but I'd hate to rob you of the nightmare you're about to experience over the next few days," she whispered into his ear. "That's pure Brachytor poison, burning its way into your eyeballs right now."
Howl groaned in horror and began to claw and rub at his eyes in panic.
"Don't worry. It's actually not lethal, but you'll wish it was. It causes an intense fever and incredibly lifelike hallucinations. It's going to bring all your greatest terrors to life, Howl. Consider this a parting gift."
With that, she was off, sprinting towards the statue, Howl's gibbering screams echoing in her ears. She clambered up onto the marble creature's wings, hauled herself up and onto its leonine skull. The window was there, barely large enough for her to squeeze through. She hesitated.
"Trust me, Miss Arklis. Go now!"
She heard shouts behind her, and more bolts skipped and whickered around her. Not much choice but to heed the man's words. Ignoring the agony in her foot, she stood, ran along the length of the statue's head, and hurled herself like an arrow towards the stained glass aperture, hands covering her head.
She felt the glass give way, and then she was falling into empty space, tucking her body tight as the ground rushed up to strike her. She hit mossy earth and rolled, crashing through a thicket of thorns that scratched and tore at her skin. Toppling out of control, she bounced painfully down a muddy slope and prayed to all the gods that there wasn't a cliff waiting at the foot of her descent. The world was a multicolored blur. Then she was falling free again, and with a bone-jarring thud, she finally came to a halt. She spent a blissful few moments just lying there, panting and trying to catch her breath as her head spun. Then she felt a hand grasp her arm and pull her to her feet. Through her pirouetting vision, she glimpsed a face staring into her own, a man's face. He appeared to be shouting at her. She snapped her head forwards into his nose. Chapter 7. Armand Callis was helping the elf to her feet when she headbutted him. His nose exploded with pain, and he staggered backwards, tripped over a clump of vines, and landed on his backside. His assailant was already running, stumbling like she was half drunk, clearly still dazed from falling down what amounted to a small cliff, which was understandable. Another figure stepped out of the undergrowth, slender and tall, dressed in a long leather greatcoat. The elf woman swung a punch at the newcomer, who simply swayed lazily to the side, caught her arm in a firm grip, and twisted, neatly flipping the elf onto her back. Captain Arika Zenthi placed a foot in between the stricken elf's shoulder blades and shot Callis a grin.
"You really do have a way with the ladies, don't you, Callis?" she said.
Callis sighed and hauled himself to his feet. Blood seeped down his face, trickling into his beard. He tenderly prodded his aching nose. Broken, of course. Perfect.
"Usually they leave it a little longer before resorting to physical violence, Zenthi," he replied.
He leaned over the prone woman, who was struggling and kicking to no avail beneath Zenthi's sharkskin boot. The captive twisted her head to the side and peered up at him. Her face was thin and angular, in the way of elf kind, but not so sharply defined as Zenthi's. Her skin was fair, darkened by the sun, and her hair a vibrant russet. One side of her face was webbed by burn marks, reaching from her chin to just below her striking green eyes.
"We have to move," she said. "We've got to get out of here, now."
"Apology accepted," he replied, nursing his injury. "Now what exactly are you doing here?"
"There's no time," the captive hissed.
Behind him, twigs crunched underfoot, and Callis turned to see Hanover Toll emerging from the trees, accompanied by several of Zenthi's retinue. The elven corsairs had already drawn steel, a variety of rapiers, daggers, and heavy-bladed cutlasses. Toll was wielding his four-barreled pistol. The man's eyes were bright with eagerness. It had been a long hunt, and the witch hunter was sensing the kill. He knelt beside the prone elf and removed his wide-brimmed hat, running a hand through his thinning hair.
"Your name," Toll said.
"It doesn't matter," she grunted. "They're coming for me."
"Good," said the witch hunter, "because the man you came here with is a killer and a heretic, and I am here to see him dead. My name is Hanover Toll, of the Most Holy Order of Azir, and you are my prisoner until such time as your own complicity in the traitor's crimes can be determined."
It was then that they heard the sound of bellowing voices, deep and guttural, accompanied by the beating of drums and the stamping of feet. Callis caught Toll's eye.
"Aurochs," he spat.
He would recognize that brutish tongue anywhere. A gunshot cracked out across the darkening sky, and flocks of startled creatures fled into the air, hooting in panicked indignation. Toll nodded to Zenthi, who hauled the prisoner to her feet.
"Quickly," he growled,
and began to climb the steep slope towards the ruined city.
Callis darted after him, drawing his own blade. He still carried his free guild steel, a span and a half of tempered metal with a basket handle. He drew his pistol, a Duardin wheel-lock piece, heavy and reassuring in his grasp. The elves of Xenthi's crew filtered after their captain, bounding up the steep ascent with graceful ease, eager for the killing to start. Even after months of sailing with these rogues, Callis still felt uneasy in their presence, like a brayhorn amidst a pack of wolves. Xenthi had handed her prisoner over to one of her crew and was now bounding ahead of the others, her long hair whipping in the breeze, twin blades held low at her side. Ahead, the ragged slope leveled off, and Callis could see lit torches and the glimmer of blades. There was a band of perhaps 20 humans, holding a set of stairs against a mob of onrushing greenskins. The steps were slick with blood, and Callis could see broken bodies piled about, forming a barrier over which the whooping oryx clambered eagerly. The night was split by a flash of light and a loud crack, as one of the men fired a scattergun into the midst of the advancing mob. Several toppled back in an explosion of pink mist. Behind the struggling warriors, in the doorway of the shattered building, stood a golden-masked figure, wrapped in black robes and carrying a staff. As they broke from cover, running towards the melee, the figure turned its head to them. Callis glanced across and saw Toll staring at the figure, his mouth set in a grim line, his fingers bone-white where they gripped his gun.
"The Maya!"
he shouted, and even over the din of battle, his voice rang clear. Then the witch hunter was running again, leveling his pistol. More oryx bounded from the ruins to their left, their voices raised in a single bestial howl of battle lust. Without even stopping, Toll aimed his gun to the side and fired. One of the onrushing creatures slumped bonelessly, a bloody hole in its skull. Callis aimed at a second figure and fired, but his shot failed to put the beast down. He had fought these brutes before and knew well how difficult it was to kill the damned things. Suddenly, they were close enough to see the creature's bloodshot eyes, to smell their rancid sweat. Captain Xenthi ducked the clumsy swing of a broad axe and spun, whipping her blade through the neck of her assailant. The oryx dropped to its knees, and she reversed her grip on the blade and brought it stabbing down through the thing's neck. It gurgled and fell to the ground, and she twisted her sword and pulled it free. Another greenskin barreled across Callis's vision and bore an elf to the ground, smashing the unfortunate soul's face into a bloody ruin with a succession of heavy punches. Callis stepped up behind the oryx and fired a bullet into its skull, and it slumped over its victim, twitching. He turned to see another elf cut down. Hot blood splattered across his face, and he stumbled backwards, cursing. More gunshots, and a piercing, haunted scream above the carnage. He blinked gore from his eyes and sought his bearings. Bodies writhed and killed and staggered in the near darkness. Toll was several paces ahead of him, hacking and weaving through the melee, fighting with a desperate frenzy quite at odds with his typical measured swordplay. A trail of bodies lay scattered behind the witch hunter, wisps of smoke rising from gaping bullet holes. But more and more oryx were splitting off to race towards him, and Toll could not carve his way through so many.
"Hanover!" shouted Callis. "Fall back, you madman! You'll get yourself killed!"
If Toll heard him, he showed no sign of it. Toll ducked back from the clumsy swing of an oryx's stone adze and thrust his blade forward, through the beast's ribcage and into its chest. The creature coughed foul-smelling blood, which splattered across his face, and without even thinking, he raised his pistol and fired point-blank into its head. He twisted his blade free and continued forward. His chest was heaving and his breath ragged. It had been a long time since he had put his body through such punishment, but his quarry was here, and this might be his only chance to serve Sigmar's justice. To see his butchered corpse strung about the city gates of Excelsis, a warning to anyone who sought to conspire against their own. Ortam Vermeier, the Golden Lord, betrayer of Excelsis, and butcher of the innocent. Once, Toll had counted him a friend. Vermeier had used that misplaced trust and his own lofty position as High Arbiter of the City of Excelsis to condemn thousands to death in the name of the Dark Gods. The judgment for that crime had been too long in coming. Another howling face loomed out of the darkness, and he swept his saber across to carve a red line across its eyes, never slowing his momentum. Ahead, the Oryks were hacking their way through Vermeier's men, overwhelming them with sheer strength and numbers. Still, the masked figure watched Toll advance, seemingly oblivious to the death and bloodshed all around him. The witch hunter was close now, perhaps 100 paces from the melee. He had no idea where the others were, but it did not matter. This was his task alone, and if he died here to end Vermeier's stain on the realms, he would do so content. Time seemed to slow. He lifted his pistol, put the traitor's head in the sight. Something struck him in the side, a dead weight that smashed him off his feet just as he pulled the trigger. His gun bucked in his hand, firing high and wide. He hit the ground alongside his assailant, where they rolled in a tangle of thrashing limbs. He punched out with the butt of his pistol, unable to free his sword hand for a killing strike, and felt it connect. There was a pained groan, and the grip on his waist loosened. He snarled and rolled his dazed opponent over, grabbed his blade, and raised it high, ready to drive it through the traitor's heart. A beam of flickering torchlight washed across the face of Armand Callis, his eyes bulging and his face bloody. Toll's hand was around the man's throat, and he was gasping for breath.
"Toll!" Callis gurgled. "It's me!"
There was a flare of blue-green light, and Toll loosened his grip on the man's throat and staggered to his feet. The golden-masked Vermeier rose over the mob of Oryks as they tore and hacked his band apart. He was borne aloft on a disk of gleaming metal, which rippled with azure flames. Arrows wickered up at him, some missing entirely, while others skipped off the floating shield, disappearing into the night. There were screams of outrage from Vermeier's remaining henchmen as they realized they were being abandoned to their fate.
"Not today, old friend," shouted Vermeier.
There wasn't even any gloating in his words. He simply sounded old and tired. Toll even imagined he heard a hint of regret. Then the man was drifting away, rising off towards the clustered rocks of the crater rim, out and away from the ruined city.
"No!"
shouted Toll. Rage and frustration welled up in him like bile, and he raised his gun once more and fired. Nothing but a dry click. Empty. He cursed, fumbling at his belt for a fresh cartridge, but it was too late. Vermeier was gone. Callis was coughing and spluttering, climbing to his knees. Toll turned and grabbed the man by his leather jerkin, slamming him against the nearest wall.
"I had him," he snarled. "I was about to put a bullet through that bastard's skull."
"You were about to get your guts ripped out by an Oryk axe," spat Callis. "And you're welcome, by the way. Next time on..."